falling about hers. His mouth tasted sweet of berries and of the strong heather drink. He undid her clothing. She had grown used to the cold. It didn't matter to her that it was cold on the grass here, that she was naked under his body. She touched him. He was warm, his body warm, his strong male member hot and strong. His hands opening her thighs were strong and eager. Her whole body welcomed him as hungrily as a virgin. She moved with him, and she felt the rhythm of the pulsing tides of the earth around her. Then she was afraid. She didn't want him to get her with child. It had gone so ill with her when Gwydion was born. Another child would surely kill her. But when she would have spoken, he laid a hand gently over her lips, and she knew he could read her thoughts. "No fear of that, sweet lady. The tides are not right for that. This is the time for pleasure, and not for ripening," he said softly. And she gave herself up to it. And yes, there were antlers shadowing his brow. She lay again with the horned one, and it was as if stars were falling in the wood all round them. Or was it but fireflies and glowworms? Once she was wandering in the woods with the maidens, and she came to a pool and bent over it, and looking deep there she saw Vivian's face looking out at her from the waters. Her hair was greying now, strands of white all through it, and there were lines she had never seen before. Her lips opened. It seemed she was calling, and Morgaine wondered, "How long have I been here? Surely I have been here 4 or 5 days, maybe even a week. I must surely go. The lady said one would guide me to the shores of Avalon." And she made her way to the lady, and told her that she must surely go. But night was falling. Surely tomorrow would be time enough. Once again in the water, it seemed she saw Arthur, his armies massing. Guinevere looked weary and somehow older. She held Lancelot by the hand as he bade them farewell, and he kissed her lips. "Yes," Morgaine thought in bitterness, "such games as he likes well to play. Guinevere would wish it so, to have all his love and devotion and never endanger her honour." But it was easy to put them away from her too. And then one night she woke with a start, hearing from somewhere a great cry, and for a moment it seemed to her as if she stood on the tor at the centre of the ringstones, hearing the terrifying cry ringing through the worlds. The voice she had heard but once since she grew to womanhood, that harsh, rusty voice grown dull with unuse, the voice of Raven, who broke her silence only when the gods had a message they dared not leave to any other. "Ah, the Pendragon has betrayed Avalon. The dragon has flown. The banner of the dragon flies no more against the Saxon warriors. Weep, weep, if the lady should set foot from Avalon, for surely she will return no more." And a sound of weeping, of sobbing in the sudden darkness. And silence. Morgaine sat upright in the greyish light, her mind suddenly clear for the first time since she had come into this country. "I have been here all too long," she thought. "Winter has come. Now, I must depart, now, before this day is over. No, I cannot even say so. The sun does not rise or set here. I must go now, at once." She knew she should call for her horse, and then remembering, she knew. Her horse was long since dead in these woods. In a sudden fright, she thought, "How long have I been here?" She searched for her dagger, and remembered that she had cast it away. She bound her dress about her. It seemed faded. She couldn't remember washing it, nor her underlinen, yet they seemed not dirtied much. She wondered suddenly if she were mad. "If I speak to the lady, she will beseech me again not to go," Morgaine tied her hair up in plaits. Why had she let it hang free? She, a grown woman. And she set off down the path which she knew would bring her to Avalon. Morgaine speaks. To this very day, I have never known how many nights and days I spent in the fairy country. Even now my mind blurs when I try to reckon it up. Try as I may, I can make it no fewer than 5, and no more than 13. Nor am I certain how much time passed in the world outside, nor in Avalon, while I was there. But because mankind keeps better records of time than the fairy folk, I know that some 5 years passed. Perhaps, and I think this more as I grow older, what we speak of as time passing happens only because we have made it a habit, in our very blood and bones, to count things. The fingers of a newborn child, the rising and returning of the sun. We think so often of how many days must pass, or how many seasons before our corn will ripen, or our child grow in the womb and come to birth, or some longed-for meeting take place. And we watch these by the turning of the year and the sun, as the first of the priestly secrets. Within the fairy country I knew nothing of the passing of time, and so for me it did not pass. For when I came out of the country, I found that already there were more lines in Guinevere's face, and Elaine's exquisite youthfulness had begun to blur a little. But my own hands were no thinner. My face was untouched by line or wrinkle. And though in our family white comes early to the hair, in his 19th year Lancelot had had already a few grey strands. My hair was black and untouched by time as the wing of a crow. I have come to think that once the Druids had taken Avalon away from the world of constant counting and reckoning, it began to happen there too. Time doesn't flow in Avalon unreckoned like the passing of a dream, as it does in the fairy country. Yet truly time has begun to drift a little. We see the moon and sun of the goddess there, and reckon the rites within the ringstones. And so time never wholly leaves us. But it runs not even with time elsewhere, though one would think that if the motion of sun and moon were known at all, it would move like to that in the world outside. Yet it is not so. Toward these last years, I could bide a month in Avalon, and discover when I came away that an entire season had sped by outside. And often, toward the end of those years, I did so, for I had no patience to see what happened in the world outside. And when folk marked that I stayed ever young, then more than ever did they call me fairy or witch. But that was long, long afterward. For when I heard Raven in that terrifying cry which moved into the spaces between the worlds, reaching my mind even where I stayed in the timeless dream of the fairy world, I set forth, but not to Avalon. Chapter 14. In the world outside, the light of the sun shone bright through fickle cloud shadows over the lake, and far away the sound of church bells rang through the air. Against that sound, Morgaine dared not raise her voice to cry the word of power which would summon the barge, nor take upon her the form of the goddess. She looked at herself in the mirrored surface of the lake. How long, she wondered, had she tarried in the fairy country? With her mind free of enchantments, she knew, even though she could reckon only 2 or 3 days, that she had dwelt there long enough for her fine dark gown to wear away, ragged where it dragged on the ground. Somewhere she had lost her dagger, or cast it away. She wasn't sure which. Now she remembered some of the things which had befallen her there as dreams or madness, and her face was stung with shame. Yet mingled with all this were memories of music sweeter than she had heard in the world, or in Avalon, or anywhere else, save when she had been at the borders of the country of death when her child was born. Almost then she had longed to cross over, if only to hear the music there. She remembered the sound of her own voice singing with the fairy harp. Never had she sung or played so sweetly. I would like to go back there, and stay there for ever. And she almost turned about to return, but the memory of Raven's fearful cry troubled her. Arthur, betraying Avalon, and the oath by which he had received the sword, and been taken into the holiest place of the Druids. And danger to Vivian should she set forth from Avalon. Slowly, trying to put things together in her mind, Morgaine remembered. She had set forth from Caerleon, it seemed, only a few days ago, in the late summer. She had never come to Avalon, and now it looked as if she never would come there. She looked sadly at the church atop the tor. If she could steal into Avalon behind the island, but the paths had carried her only into the fairy country. Somewhere, then, she had lost both dagger and horse. And now she remembered seeing bleached bone and shuddered. And now, she came to take note, the church on the tor seemed different. The priests must have been building on it. And surely they couldn't have built it so big in a month or even two. Somehow, she thought, gripping her hands together in sudden fright, I must find out how many moons have sped by while I wandered with the maidens of the lady, or took my pleasure with the ferryman who led me there. But no, it couldn't have been more than two, or at most three nights, she thought wildly. Not knowing, it was the beginning of a confusion which would grow endlessly, and never be wholly settled in her mind. And now, when she thought of those nights, she was frightened and ashamed, trembling with the memory of a pleasure she had never known, lying in the arms of the ferryman. And yet, now she was away from the enchantment, it seemed like something shameful, done in a dream. And the caresses she had given and received from the fairy maidens, something she could never have dreamed without such an enchantment. There had befallen something, too, with the lady. And now she thought of it, the lady was much like Vivian, and Morgaine was shamed, too. In the fairy country it had been as if she had hungered all her life for such things, and yet in the outside world she would never have dared it, or even dreamed of it. Despite the warm sun, she had begun to shiver. She didn't know what time of year it might be, but there were patches of unmelted snow on the edge of the lake, hiding in the reeds. In the name of the goddess, can the winter have passed and spring be at hand again? And if enough time had gone by in the outside world so that Arthur could have planned betrayal of Avalon, then it must have been longer than she dared to think. She had lost horse and dagger and everything else she had had with her. Her shoes, too, were worn. She had no food with her. And she was alone on the shores of unfriendly country, far from any place where she was known as the king's sister. Well, she had gone hungry before this. A flicker of a smile passed over her face. There were great houses and nunneries where she would, perhaps, be given bread as a beggar. She would make her way to the court of Arthur. Perhaps somewhere she would come on a village where someone would need the services of a midwife, so that she could barter her skill for bread. She gave one last longing look at the shores across the lake. Dared she make a final attempt to speak the word of power which would bring her into Avalon? If she could speak with Raven, perhaps she could know precisely what danger threatened. She opened her mouth to cry out the word and drew back. She couldn't face Raven, either. Raven, who had kept the laws of Avalon so meticulously, who had done nothing to shame her priestess garb. How could she face Raven's clear eyes with the memories of what she had done in the outside world, and in the fairy country? Raven would have them from her mind in a moment. At last, the shores of the lake and the spire of the church blurring through tears, she turned her back on Avalon to find the Roman road that led away south, past the mines, and at last to Caerleon. She had been 3 days on the road before she met with another traveller. The first night she had slept in an abandoned herder's hut, supperless, sheltering from the wind, but no more. On the second day she had come to a farmstead where the folk were all from home, except for a half-witted goose-boy. But he had let her sit to warm herself by the banked fire inside, and she had taken a thorn from his foot, so that he gave her a hunk of his bread. She had walked farther with less to eat. But then she came nearer to Caerleon, and was shocked to find 2 burned-out houses and crops rotting in the field. It was as if Saxons had passed this way. She went into one of the houses, which looked as if it had been sacked, for there was little left. But lying in one of the rooms, she found an old and faded cloak, too ragged, she supposed, even for the raiders to take, abandoned by someone when they fled the place. It was warm wool, though, and Morgaine wrapped it round herself, though it made her look more than ever like a beggar woman. She had suffered more from the cold than from hunger. Near dusk some fowls clucked in the abandoned court. Hens were creatures of habit. They hadn't yet learned that they could not come here to be fed. Morgaine caught one of them and wrung its neck, and in the ruined fireplace kindled a small fire. If she was lucky, no one would see the smoke coming from the ruins, or if they did, would think it was but ghosts. She spitted the chicken and roasted it on a green stick of wood over her fire. It was so old and tough that even her strong teeth had trouble chewing it, but she had been hungry so long that she didn't care, and sucked the bones as if it were the daintiest of roast birds. She found some leather, too, in one of the outbuildings which had been some sort of forge or smithy. They had carried off every tool and every last scrap of metal, but there were some bits of leather lying about, and Morgaine wrapped what was left of the hen in it. She would have mended her shoes, too, but she had no knife. Well, perhaps she would come to a village where she might get the loan of one for a few minutes. What madness had prompted her to cast her dagger away? It was several days after full moon, and when she set forth from the ruined farm, there was frost on the stone doorstep, and a gibbous day-moon lingered in the sky. As she crossed the door-sill with her leather bag of cold meat and a thick stick clenched in her hand, some shepherd, no doubt, had cut it and left it here, she heard a hen clucking somewhere in wild announcement, and she sought out the nest and ate the egg raw and still warm from the hen's body, so she felt full-fed and comfortable. The wind was brisk and cold, and she walked at a good pace, glad of the cloak, threadbare and torn though it was. The morning was far advanced, and she was beginning to think of sitting herself down by the road and eating some of the cold fowl, when she heard hooves behind her on the road, overtaking her. Her first thought was to continue on her way. She was bent on her own affairs, and had as good a right to the road as any other traveller. Then, remembering the ruin of the farm, she took thought, and went to the side of the road, concealing herself behind a bush. There was no way to tell what manner of folk travelled the roads now, with Arthur too busy keeping the peace against the Saxons to have much time to create peace in the countryside and protection along the roads. If the traveller seemed harmless, she might ask him what news. If not, well, she would lie here, hidden, until he was out of sight. It was a solitary horseman, wrapped in a grey cloak and riding on a tall, lean horse, riding alone, with no servant or pack-horse. No, but he bore a great pack behind him. No, not that either. It was that his body was hunched over in the saddle. And then she knew who the man must be, and stepped out from her place of concealment. "Kevin Harper," she said. He drew up his horse. It was well trained and didn't rear or sidle. He looked down at her, scowling, his mouth twisted in a sneer. Or was it but the scars he bore?
"I have nothing for you, woman."
And then he broke off. "By the goddess, it is the Lady Morgaine. What do you hear, madam? I had heard last year that you were in Tintagel with your mother before she died. But when the High Queen went south to her burying, she said, no, you hadn't been there." Morgaine reeled and put out a hand to steady herself on her stick. "My mother dead? I had not heard." Kevin dismounted, steadying himself against the horse's flank until he got his stick under him.
"Sit you down here, madam."
"You had not heard? Where in the name of the goddess have you been?"
"The word came even to Vivian in Avalon, but she is now too old and too frail to go forth."
"But where I was," Morgaine thought, "I heard it not. It may be that when I saw Igraine's face in the forest pool, then was she calling to me with the news, and I never knew." Pain wrenched at her heart. She and Igraine had grown so far from each other. They had parted soon after she was 11 years old and gone forth to Avalon. Yet now it tore at her with anguish, as if she were that same little girl who had wept when she left Igraine's house. "Oh, my mother, and I knew nothing of it." She sat at the edge of the road, tears streaming down her face. "How did she die? Have you heard?"
"Her heart, I believe. It was 1 year ago in the spring. Believe me, Morgaine, I heard nothing but that it was natural and expected for her years."
For a moment, Morgaine couldn't control her voice enough to speak. And with the grief, there was terror. For clearly she had dwelt out of the world longer than she had thought possible. Kevin said, 1 year ago in the spring. So more than one spring had gone by while she lingered in the fairy country. For in the summer, when she left Arthur's court, Igraine hadn't even been ailing. It was not a question of how many months she had been gone, but how many years. And could she get Kevin to tell her without revealing where she had been?
"There is wine in my saddlebag, Morgaine. I would offer it to you, but you must get it for yourself. I walk not well at the best of times. You look thin and pale. Are you hungry too? And how is it that I find you on this road clothed?" Kevin wrinkled his brow in fastidious distaste. "Worse than any beggar woman."
Morgaine cast about in her mind for what she could say. "I have dwelt in solitude and away from the world. I have not seen or spoken with any man for I know not how long. I had lost count even of the seasons." And this much was true, for whatever the folk of the fairy country might be, they were not mankind.
"I can well believe it," said Kevin. "I could believe even that you had not heard of the great battle."
"I see that this country has been all burned over."
"Oh, that was 3 years ago," said Kevin,
and Morgaine started back.
"Some of the treaty troops broke their vows and came all through this country, looting and burning. Arthur took a great wound at that battle, and lay abed for 1/2 year.
He saw Morgaine's troubled face and mistook her concern.
"Oh, he does well enough now, but all that time he didn't set foot to the ground. I imagine he felt the want of your healing skills, Morgaine." "Then Gawain led down all of Lot's men from the north, and we had peace for 3 years. And then this summer passed, there was the great battle at Mount Baden. Lot died in that battle. Aye, there was a victory, such as bards will sing for 100 years,
Kevin said.
"I do not think there is a Saxon chief left unkilled in all this land from Cornwall to Lothian, save those who call Arthur their king. There has been nothing like it since the days of the Caesars, and now all this land lies under the peace of Arthur."
Morgaine had risen and gone to the saddlebags. She found the flask of wine, and Kevin said,
"Bring the bread and cheese, too. It is near noon, and I will eat here with you."
When she had served him and opened her roll of leather with the remains of the chicken, offering it, he shook his head.
"Thank you, but I eat no flesh food now. I am under vows." "I marvel to see you eat meat, Morgaine, a priestess of your rank."
"That or go fasting," said Morgaine, and told him how the chicken had come to her. "But I have not observed that prohibition since I left Avalon. I eat such things as are set before me."
"For myself, I think it makes little matter, flesh or fish or grain," Kevin said, "though the Christians make much of their fasting. At least this Patricius, who is Arthur's bishop now. Before that, the brethren who dwelt with us upon Avalon used to repeat a saying of their Christ, that it was not what went into a man's mouth that defiled him, but what came out of it, and therefore man should eat humbly of all the gifts of God. And so I have heard Taliesin say. But for myself, no doubt you know that at a certain level of the mysteries, what is eaten has so much effect on the mind. I dare not eat meat now. It makes me drunker than too much wine."
Morgaine nodded. She had had that experience too. When she had been drinking the sacred herbs, she could eat nothing but a little bread and fruit. Even cheese or boiled lentils were too rich and made her ill.
"But where do you go now, Morgaine?"
And when she told him, he stared as if she were mad.
"To Caerleon? Why? There's nothing there."
"Or perhaps you didn't know, though I find that hard to believe. Arthur gave it to one of his knights who served him well at that battle. But on the day of Pentecost, he moved his whole court to Camelot. It will be a year this summer that he has dwelt there. Taliesin liked that not, that he opened his court upon the Christian holy day, but he did it to please his queen. He listens to her in all things."
Morgaine surprised a faint grimace on his face.
"But then, if you had not heard of the battle, it is likely you had not heard how Arthur betrayed the folk of Avalon and the tribes."
Morgaine stopped the cup halfway to her lips. She said, "It is for that I came, Kevin. I heard that Raven had broken her silence and prophesied some such thing as that."
"It was more than prophecy," said the bard.
He stretched his leg uneasily, as if sitting for long in one position on the ground hurt him. "Arthur betrayed... what did he do?" Morgaine's breath caught. "He did not give them into the hands of the Saxons."
"You have not heard, then. The tribes were sworn to follow the banner of the Pendragon, as they swore at his king-making, and Uther's before him. And the little folk of the days before the tribes, they came too, with their bronze axes and flint hatchets and elf arrows. No more than the fairy folk can they bear cold iron. All sworn to follow the great dragon. And Arthur betrayed them. He put away the dragon standard, even though we begged him that he should let Gawain or Lancelot bear it into the field. But he swore that he would raise only his banner of the cross and the Holy Virgin into the field at Mount Baden. And so he did."
Morgaine stared in horror, remembering Arthur's king-making. Even Uther had not so pledged himself to the folk of Avalon. And he had betrayed that pledge? She whispered, "And the tribes didn't desert him?"
Kevin said in great anger, "Some of them came near to it. Some of the old people from the Welsh hills did indeed go home when the cross was raised. King Urien's couldn't stop them. As for the rest, well, we knew that day that the Saxons had us between the hammer and the anvil. We might follow Arthur and his knights into battle, or live thereafter under Saxon rule. For this was the great battle that had been prophesied. and he bore the sacred sword Excalibur from the holy regalia. Like enough, the goddess herself knew that she would be the worse if the land was ruled by the Saxons. So he fought, and the goddess gave him victory.
Kevin offered the wine flask to Morgaine, and when she shook her head, he drained it.
"Vivian would have come from Avalon to charge him with oath-breaking," he said, "but she is reluctant to do so before all his people. And so I am for Camelot, to remind him of his vow. And if he heeds not that, then Vivian has sworn she will come to Camelot herself on the day when all people present their petitions, and Arthur has sworn he himself will hear and judge them at Pentecost. And then, she said, she would stand before him as a common petitioner and claim his oath, and remind him of what must befall him who forswears his word."
Morgaine said, "The goddess grant that the Lady of the Lake need never humble herself so far."
"I too would speak to him with wrath, not soft words, but it is not mine to choose," said Kevin.
He held out his hand.
"Will you help me to rise? I think my horse will bear too, and if not, when we come to a town we must get you a horse. I should be gallant, even as the great Lancelot, and let you ride mine, but..."
He pointed to his crippled body. Morgaine pulled him to his feet. "I'm strong. I can walk. If we must barter anything in the town, we should find shoes for me and a knife. I have not a single coin with me, but I will repay you when I can." Kevin shrugged.
"You are my vowed sister in Avalon. What I have is yours. So runs the law. There is no talk of payment between us."
Morgaine felt herself colouring in shame that Kevin should so remind her of what she had sworn. "I have been out of the world in truth. Let me help you to mount your horse. Will she stand so?" He smiled.
"If she would not, she would be little use to me in travelling such roads as I go alone. Let us go. I would like to reach Camelot tomorrow."
In a town nestled in the hills, they found a cobbler to mend Morgaine's broken shoes, and an old bronze dagger. The man who had these things for sale said there was no dearth of them in this country since the great battle. Kevin bought her a decent cloak, too, saying the ragged one she had found in the farmhouse would scarce make a saddle blanket. But the stop had delayed them, and once on the road again, it began to snow heavily, and the dark closed in early.
"We should have stayed in that town," said Kevin. "I could have bartered harp music for supper and a bed for us both. Alone, I could sleep under a hedge or in the shelter of a wall wrapped in my cloak, but not a lady of Avalon."
"What makes you think I have never slept so?" Morgaine asked.
He laughed. "You look to me, Morgaine, as if you had slept so all too often of late. But no matter how swiftly we press the horse, we cannot come to Camelot this night. We must look somewhere for shelter."
After a time, through the fast-falling snow, they could make out the dark shape of an abandoned building. Not even Morgaine could enter it walking upright. Likely it had been a cattle buyer. But the beasts had been gone so long that there wasn't even a smell, and the thatch and daub roof was mostly in place. They tethered the horse and crawled in, Kevin directing her with a gesture to lay the old ragged cloak on the filthy floor, and they each wrapped themselves in their cloaks and lay down side by side. But it was so cold that at last, hearing Morgaine's teeth chattering, Kevin said they must spread the two cloaks over them both and lie close together for warmth.
"If it will not sicken you to be so close to this misshapen body of mine," he said.
And she could hear the pain and anger in his voice. "Of what is misshapen about you, Kevin Harper? I know only that with your broken hands you make more music than I, or even Taliesin, with hands that are whole," Morgaine said. and moved gratefully into his warmth. And at last she felt she could sleep, her head resting in the curve of his shoulder. She had been walking all day and was weary. She slept heavily, but wakened when the light began to steal through the cracks in the broken wall. She felt cramped from the hard floor, and as she looked round the mud-daubed wall, she felt a surge of horror. She, Morgaine, priestess of Avalon, Duchess of Cornwall, lying here in a beast shelter, cast out from Avalon. Would she ever return? And she had come from worse places, from the castle chariot in the fairy country, out of all knowledge of Christendom and heathendom alike, out of the very doors of this world. She, who had been so delicately reared by Igraine, she who was sister to the High King, schooled by the Lady of the Lake, accepted by the Goddess. Now had she cast it all away? But no, she had not cast it away. It had been taken from her when Vivian sent her to the king-making, and she had come away with child by her own brother. Igraine is dead. My mother is dead. And I cannot come again to Avalon, never in this world. And then Morgaine was weeping hopelessly, muffling her sobs in the coarse stuff of the cloak. Kevin's voice was soft and husky in the half-light. Do you weep for your mother, Morgaine?
For my mother, and for Vivian, and perhaps most of all for myself.
Morgaine was never certain whether she had spoken the words aloud. Kevin's arm circled her, and she let her head fall against his chest, and wept, until she could weep no more. He said, after a long time, still stroking her hair, "You spoke truth, Morgaine. You do not shrink from me."
"How could I?" she said, nestling closer, "when you have been so kind."
"All women think not so," he said. "Even when I came to the Beltane fires, I heard, for some folk think that because my legs and hands are lame, I am also deaf and dumb, I heard more than one, even of the maidens of the goddess, whisper to their priestess that she should place them afar from me, so that there would be no chance I would look upon them when the time came to go apart from the fires." Morgaine sat upright in dismay. "Were I that priestess, I would drive such a woman forth from the fires, because she dared to question the form in which the god might come to her."
"What did you do, Kevin?"
He shrugged. "Rather than interrupt the ritual or put any woman to such a choice, I went away so quietly that none knew. Even the god could never change what they see or think of me. Even before I was forbidden by the druid vows to couple with women who barter their bodies for gold, I could pay no woman to accept me. Perhaps I should seek to be a priest among the Christians, who, I have heard, teach their priests the secret of living without women. Or perhaps I should wish that when the raiders broke my hands and body, they had gelded me too, so that I should not care one way or the other. I'm sorry. I should not speak of it. But I wonder if you consented to lie at my side because you thought this crooked body of mine wasn't a man's and didn't think of me so." Morgaine listened to him, appalled at the agony of bitterness in his words, the wounds dealt to his manhood. She knew the awareness that lived in his hands, the quick emotion of the musician. Even before the goddess, could women look only at a broken body? She remembered how she had flung herself into Lancelot's arms, and the wound to her pride, which, she knew, would never cease to bleed. Quite deliberately, she bent down and kissed him on the lips, pulled his hand to her, and kissed the scars there.
"Never doubt it. To me you are a man, and the goddess has prompted me to do this."
She lay down again, turning toward him. He looked sharply at her in the growing light. For a moment she flinched at what she saw in his face.
Did he think she pitied him?
No. She shared the awareness of his suffering, which was another thing. She looked him directly in the eyes. Yes. If his face had not been so drawn with bitterness, so twisted with suffering, he might have been handsome. His features were good, his eyes very dark and gentle. Fate had broken his body, but not his spirit. No coward could have endured the ordeals of the Druids.
Under the mantle of the goddess, as every woman is my sister and my daughter and my mother, so must every man be to me as father and lover and son. My father was dead before I could remember him, and I have not seen my son since he was weaned. But to this man I will give what the goddess prompts me.
Morgaine kissed one of the scarred hands again, and laid it inside her gown, against her breast. He was inexperienced, which seemed to her strange for a man of his age.
But how, Morgaine wondered, could he possibly have been anything else?
And then she thought, this is the first time, really, that I have done this of my free will, and had the gift taken simply as it was offered. It healed something in her. Strange that it could have been so with a man she scarcely knew, and for whom she felt only kindness. Even in his inexperience he was generous and gentle with her, and she felt, welling up within her, a great and unspeakable tenderness.
"It's strange," he said at last, in a quiet, musing voice. "I had known you were wise and a priestess, but somehow I had never thought you were beautiful." She laughed harshly.
"Beautiful? Me?" But she was grateful that to him at that moment she seemed so.
"Morgaine, tell me, where have you been? I wouldn't ask, but that whatever it is, it lies heavy on your heart."
"I don't know," she blurted out. She had never thought she would tell him. "Out of the world, perhaps. I was trying to reach Avalon, and I couldn't come there. The way is barred to me, I think. Twice now I have been elsewhere. Another country, a country of dreams and enchantments. A country where time stands still and is not. And there is nothing but music." And she fell silent. Would the harper think her a madwoman? He traced a finger along the corner of her eye. It was cold, and they had thrown the covers off them. He tucked the cloaks gently round her again.
"Once I too was there and heard their music," he said, in a distant, brooding voice. "And in that place, I wasn't near so crippled, and their women didn't mock me. Some day, perhaps, when I have lost my fear of madness, I shall go to them once again. They showed me the hidden ways, and said I might come because of my music." And again his soft voice dropped into a long silence. She shivered and looked away from him. "We had better get up. If our poor horse hasn't quite frozen in the night, we will arrive at Camelot this day."
"And if we arrive together," Kevin said quietly, "they may believe that you have come with me from Avalon. It is none of their affair where you have dwelt. You are a priestess, and your conscience is not in the keeping of any man alive, not even of their bishops, or of Taliesin himself." Morgaine wished she had a decent dress to put on. She would arrive at Arthur's court in the garb of a beggar woman. Well, it couldn't be helped. Kevin watched as she arranged her hair, then held out his hand, and she helped him to his feet, matter-of-factly. But she saw that the bitter look was in his eyes again. He was guarded behind 100 fences of reserve and anger. Yet, just as they were crawling out the door, he touched her hand.
"I have not thanked you, Morgaine."
She smiled. "Oh, If there are thanks, they are to be spoken both ways, my friend.
Or could you not tell that?
For a moment, the scarred fingers tightened on hers. And then it was like a blaze of fire. She saw his ravaged face circled with a ring of fire, contorted with shrieking, and all about and all around him fire. Fire. She stiffened and snatched her hand away, staring at him in horror.
"Morgaine," he cried. "What is it?"
"Nothing. Nothing. A cramp in my foot," she lied, and avoided his hand when he would have put it out to steady her. Death. Death by burning. What did it mean? Not even the worst of traitors died that death. Or had she seen only what had befallen him when he was lamed as a boy? Brief as the moment of sight had been, it left her shaken, as if she herself had spoken the word that would deliver him to his death.
"Come," she said, almost brusquely. "Let us ride."
Chapter 15. Guinevere had never wished to meddle with the sight. Did it not say in Holy Writ that no man knew what a day might bring forth? Yet she had hardly thought of Morgaine in the last year, not since they had moved the court to Camelot. But this very morning she had wakened, remembering a dream she had had of Morgaine. A dream in which Morgaine had taken her hand, leading her to the Beltane fires, and bidding her lie with Lancelot there. When she was well awake, she could laugh at the madness of that dream. Surely dreams were sent from the devil, for in all of hers that gave her such evil counsel that no Christian wife could heed, oftenest it was Morgaine who spoke it. "Well, she is gone from this court. I need never think of her again. No, I do not wish her ill. I wish she might repent of her sins and find peace in a nunnery. But one very far from here." Now that Arthur had given over his pagan ways, Guinevere felt that she would be happy if it were not for those dreams in which Morgaine led her into shameful things. And now the dream haunted her while she sat working at the altar cloth she was making for the church, haunted her so deeply that it seemed wicked to sit working across in gold thread while she thought of Lancelot. She put down her thread and whispered a prayer, but her thoughts went on, relentless. Arthur, when she begged him at Christmas, had promised her that he would put down the Beltane fires in the countryside. She thought he would have done it before this, except that the Merlin had forbidden him. It would be hard for any, Guinevere thought, not to love the old man. He was so gentle and good. If only he were Christian, he would be better than any priest. But Taliesin had said it wasn't fair to the country folk, either, to take from them a simple awareness of a goddess who cared for their fields and their crops, and the fertility of their beasts and their own wombs. Surely there was little that such folk could do in the way of sin. They had all they could do to toil in the fields and till their crops for enough bread to keep them out of death's reach. It wasn't to be looked for that the devil should trouble himself with such people, if there was a devil at all. But Guinevere said, "I suppose you think they do no sin when they go to the Beltane fires, and there do lewd and heathen rites and lie with other than their husbands." "God knows they have little enough joy in their lives," Taliesin responded tranquilly. "I cannot think it very wrong that four times in a whole year, when the seasons turn, they should make merry and do what pleasures them. I could not find much reason to love a god who took thought about such things and would call them wicked. Do you call them wicked, my queen?" And she did. Any Christian woman must think so. To go into the fields and dance naked and lie there with the first man sent to her? Immodest and shameful and wicked. Taliesin shook his head, sighing. "Still, my queen, none can be the master of another's conscience.
even if you think it wicked and shameful. Would you pretend to know what is right for another? Even the wise cannot know everything, and perhaps the gods have more purposes than we, in our little knowledge, can see.
If I knew right from wrong, as I do, and as the priests have taught us, and as God has taught us in Holy Writ, then should I fear God's punishment if I did not make such laws as would keep my people from sin? Guinevere demanded. God would require it at my hands, I think, if I allowed evil to take place in my realm, and if I were king, I should already have put it down.
Then, lady, I can say only that it is the good fortune of this land that you are not king. A king must protect his people from outsiders, from invaders, and lead his people to defend themselves. A king must be the first to thrust himself between the land and all danger, just as a farmer stands to defend his fields from any robber. But it is not his duty to dictate to them what their innermost hearts may do.
But she had debated with him hotly. A king is the protector of his people, and what good is it to protect their bodies if he lets their souls fall into evil ways? Look you, Lord Merlin, I am a queen, and mothers in this land send their daughters to wait upon me and be schooled in courtly ways, understand you? Well, what manner of queen should I be if I let another woman's daughter behave immodestly and get herself with child, or, as did Queen Morgause, I have heard, let her maidens go to the king's bed if he wished to have his way with them? Mothers entrust me with their daughters because they know I will protect them.
It is different that you should be entrusted with maidens too young to know their own will, and be even as a mother to bring them up rightly,
Taliesin said.
But a king rules over grown men.
God has not said there is one law for the court and one other for the country folk. He wishes all men to keep his commandments. And suppose the laws were not here?
What do you think would happen to this land if I and my ladies went out into the fields and behaved so immodestly?
How can such things be allowed to go on within the very sound of the church bells?
Taliesin smiled. He said, I do not think, even if there was no law against it, that you would be very likely to go into the fields at Beltane, my lady. I have marked it that you like not to go out of doors much at all.
I have had the good of Christian teaching and priestly counsel, and I choose not to go, she said sharply.
But Guinevere,
he said very gently, his faded blue eyes looking at her out of the network of lines and patches on his face,
think of this. Suppose a law was made against it, and your conscience told you that it was the right thing to do, to give yourself to the goddess in acknowledgement that she is over us all, body and soul. If your goddess wished for you to do so, then, dear lady, would you let the passing of a law forbidding the Beltane fires stop you from it? Think, dear lady, not more than 200 years ago, has Bishop Patricius not told you of this? It was strictly against the laws here in the summer country that any should worship the Christ, for so they should defraud the gods of Rome of their just and righteous due. And there were Christians who died rather than do such a little thing, cast a pinch of incense before one of their idols. Aye, I see you have heard the story. Would you have your God be as great a tyrant as any Roman emperor?
But God is real, and they are but idols fashioned by men, Guinevere said.
Not so, no more than the picture of Mary Virgin which Arthur bore into battle, said Taliesin. A picture to give comfort to the minds of the faithful. It is strictly forbidden to me, a Druid, that I may have any representation of any god, for I have been so taught in many lives that I need none. I can think upon my God, and he is with me. But the once-born cannot do that, and so they need their goddess in round stones and pools,
as your simple people need the picture of Mary Virgin and the cross which some of your knights bear on their shields, so that men may know they are Christian knights.
Guinevere knew there was a flaw in this argument, but she couldn't debate with the Merlin, and in any case, he was only an old man and a heathen.
"When I have borne Arthur a son," once he said to me, "that then I might ask of him anything he could give. And at that time I will ask him to forbid the Beltane fires and the harvest fires." Guinevere remembered this conversation months after, on the morning of her dream. No doubt Morgaine would have counselled her so, that she should go with Lancelot to the fires. Arthur had said he would ask her no question if she should bear a child. He had all but given her leave to have Lancelot as a lover. She felt her face flaming as she bent over the cross. She wasn't fit to touch such stuff. She put the altar cloth from her and wrapped it in a piece of coarser cloth. She would work on it when she was more tranquil. Kai's uneven step sounded at the door of the room.
"My lady," he said, "the king has sent to ask if you would come down to the arms field to watch. There's something he would show you."
Guinevere nodded to her ladies. "Elaine, Melias, come with me," she said. "You others, you may come, or stay here and work, as you like."
One of the women, who was elderly and somewhat short-sighted, chose to stay and go on with her spinning. The others, eager for a chance to get out into the sunlight, flocked after Guinevere. In the night there had been snow, but the strength of the winter was past, and now the snow lay melting quickly in the sun. Little bulbs were poking leaves through the grass. In another month, this would be a wilderness of flowers. When she had come here to Camelot, her father, Leodegrance, had sent her his favourite gardener, so that he could decide what vegetables and pot herbs would grow best in this site. But this hilltop had been fortified long before Roman times, and there were some herbs growing. Guinevere had had him transplant them all into her kitchen garden. And when they found a patch where flowers were growing wild, Guinevere begged Arthur that she should be left it for her own lawns, and he had built the arms field further along the hilltop. She looked up timidly as they moved across the lawns. It was so open here, so near to the sky. Caerleon had nestled close to the earth. Here, at Camelot, on rainy days, it was like being on an island of fog and mist, like Avalon. But on clear days of sunlight, such as this one, it lay high and exposed, so that it could command all the country round, and standing at the edge of the hilltop, she could see miles and miles of hill and forest. It was like being too near to heaven. Surely it wasn't right that human beings, mere mortals, should see so far. But Arthur said, even though there was peace in the land, the king's castle should be difficult to come at. It wasn't Arthur who came to meet her, but Lancelot. He had grown even handsomer, she thought. Now that he need not keep his hair always hacked short for the war helmet, he had let it grow long, and it curled around his shoulders. He wore a short beard. She liked the fashion on him, though Arthur teased him about it, and said he was vain. Arthur himself kept his hair clipped short like a soldier, and had himself shaved every day by his chamberlains as carefully and as closely as he combed his hair.
"Lady, the king is waiting for you," said Lancelot, and took her arm to escort her to the set of seats Arthur had had built close to the wooden railings of the exercise field. Arthur bowed to her, thanking Lancelot with a smile as he took Guinevere's hand.
"Here, Gwen, sit beside me. I brought you here because I want to show you something special. Look there."
She could see that a group of the younger knights and some of the youngsters who served in the king's house were working at a mock battle in the yard. Divided into two groups, they were fighting with wooden batons and big shields.
"Look,"
said Arthur. "The big one in the ragged saffron shirt. Does he not put you in mind of someone?"